The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. My name's Vic McCunis. I've been hosting this show for a few years, and back in 1997, I had the pleasure of doing my only interview with a woman in Canada named Barbara Noska. She's originally from Holland, and during this interview, she gives us her bio, or at least a portion of it. And back in the 1990s, she created a term which never became widely used, but she's known for it, and the term was animal industrial complex. And we'll find out what she means by that in our interview for her book, Beyond Boundaries, Humans and Animals. Let's listen now to Barbara Noska on the Best of the Book Nook.
Tell us why you wrote this book.
Oh, that has both an emotional reason and a theoretical reason. An emotional reason is really goes back all the way to my very, very, very young childhood. I was lying. I'm originally from Holland. I was lying in a cradle outside in my mother's garden, and a dog from the neighbors entered our garden and lay herself beside me and virtually started my first, not human animal, but animal human relationship, because she started it, and she was a 2-year-old dog, so she was both physically and mentally my superior. And so later I found that people thought, you know, that animals were lower than us, I got an idea of human-animal relationships conveyed to me later that didn't at all correspond with my own almost imprinting. So that's the emotional reason. I have a kind of gut feeling of equality between humans and animals, because I've experienced it that way. So later I was kind of bewildered by the way that Western philosophy and religion and so on looked upon animals. And also I found, as a student of anthropology and philosophy, as a student of social science and humanities, I suddenly realized that animals were so absent from what I was doing professionally. So I brought animals back in. And that is probably the reason. I don't know. There's many other reasons, of course. Why do you write a book? A book almost writes you. It's not always a totally conscious process. You just start thinking and you start writing.
My guest is Barbara Noska, and the book is Beyond Boundaries, Humans and Animals. As a culture in modern times, we treat animals as objects, don't we?
Yeah, well, the Hong Kong example that you just gave, which is virtually, it's one of the many diseases that regularly break out in animal factory farming, and it just shows the excesses that we've arrived at, the way we use animals only as meat. I mean, birds are not just meat. If they are only meat, we are only meat. But having animals in masses like that leads to all kinds of diseases. In the Netherlands, they have had a year of what they call porcine pestilence, and they did exactly the same there. They killed not only the diseased animals, but because the European Union banned Dutch pig meat, they and the barns overflowed because they didn't take the sows out of the farrowing stalls where they breed and breed and breed and breed, and these sows are chained all their lives in these farrowing stalls. So there was an overflowing of piglets, and they killed a million totally healthy piglets. And in a way, they're not totally wasteful and totally unnecessary because they refused to take the breeding sows out of the farrowing stalls because they said, yeah, they get out of the habit that way, and that will result in an economic loss. So, I mean, animals, our production animals are just figures, are just economic assets or economic losses. And, that's the way we think of them. They're objects and instruments. They're not our kin anymore.
And we don't pay any attention to their suffering or their pain or their...
Or their potential. Their potential. I mean, it's not... It's animals, there's no living form that was made only for us. In the wild, in the end, probably most prey animals would be killed. Yes, but before that, they have an animal-worthy life. And we restrict that life to a barn or a concrete floor or research laboratory. And, we draw an enormous line between humankind on the one hand and all animals on the other hand. And only we are ethical beings and only we are our subjects, and the rest of the living world is an object for us to use to bend to our purposes.
My guest is Barbara Noska. The book is Beyond Boundaries, Humans and Animals. We had the story about the chickens in Hong Kong. We also had a story in the news today about hog confinement operations.
Oh, yes.
And the problems being created by the waste, polluting and endangering humans. And it seems that the only time that we hear stories like this is when it has an impact on humans.
Yeah, it's totally anthropocentric. And I as you said, in Canada also there is a huge discussion going on in the prairies. So that's Saskatchewan, Alberta. They start with intensive pig farming there too. And the only argument that is being heard by people who act against it or who voice opinions against these forms of farming, all the arguments you hear are generally all human-centered. But there is a risk. I mean, coming from the Netherlands, as I just said, we have a huge manure problem in the Netherlands, produced by factory farming, because the manure, it's the quantities of the manure, that's one thing, but the other thing is that the manure is polluted, because what in the Netherlands, for instance, you can't get pig feed anymore that doesn't contain antibiotics and that doesn't contain growth devices. Like, they add copper to the pig feed because copper makes pigs fatten more quickly, and the copper just passes through the pigs and gets into the manure and gets into the soil and the subsoil waters. And of course, you have a bit more space here, but the Netherlands is a small country and there's a huge manure problem, also resulting in acid rain because it also contributes to air pollution.
And
but all these things are, of course, exactly as you said, human-centered. As soon as they impact on human quality of life, then it gets publicity. But what happens inside these hog farms? I mean, pigs are really inquisitive, intelligent, playful animals, and they were not meant to live their whole life on concrete floors in darkness, never feel the air, never see the sun. I mean, no living being was meant to live that way.
But as a culture, we have grown to believe that animals are machines and they don't have any feelings. So why would this bother them not to have contact, not to have freedom, not to have sunlight?
Yeah, well, that's of course, that goes back to the French philosopher Descartes, the Cartesian view of the animal machine, animal machine, the idea that bodies are just machines, that there is no sensation, that there is no mind, that there is no subjectivity in animals. And that is part of our Western culture, I'm afraid. So that goes back to the 17th century, and not much has changed because technology has virtually fulfilled what Descartes thought out in theory. They have fulfilled in practice.
My guest is Barbara Noska. The book is Beyond Boundaries, Humans and Animals. I found out a lot of things by reading this book that I was not aware of. I was not aware of the fact that these philosophers and scientists over the years had come up with these ideas that placed men above women and humans above nature, and that women are supposedly part of nature more than men, and therefore they are inferior. I didn't know any of this.
That goes back a lot further than Descartes. That goes back even to the ancient Greeks, where already women are seen as closer to nature, and men as beings who transcend nature and create culture. Like, culture seen in that way is always transformation and transcendence of nature. So the hierarchy between culture and nature you can find already in Greek thought. You can see that in Plato and to a degree also in Aristotle, for instance. And these ideas still had a lot of influence also in the Middle Ages, because the church in medieval Europe debated for a long time. Of course, man, and I really mean man was made in God's image, and man was also the one that would have part of the afterlife, and also man was the one that had a soul. The soul of women for a long time was doubtful, and animals had no souls. Animals were living for to praise God's creation on earth, and they were also the highest performance of God's creation on earth apart from humans. But when they were dying, they were actually going to die totally. There was no afterlife for animals in medieval thought. And so the hierarchy between humans and animals, and within the human realm between men and women, that hierarchy we've lived with for a long time.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back almost 30 years to an interview I did with a woman named Barbara Noska. She was in Canada. She's originally from the Netherlands. And her book, Beyond Boundaries, Humans and Animals, was a powerful book. And it made me think a lot about our relationship with animals. And we'll continue with this conversation from the Best of the Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, fact-based journalism in service of democracy, right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. Back in 1997, I did my only interview with a woman in Canada named Barbara Noska. She's originally from Holland, and she'd written a book about our relationship with animals. Let's listen now on the Best of the Book Nook.
My guest is Barbara Noska, the book Beyond Boundaries, Humans and Animals. Barbara, you make a number of points in the book, one of which is that environmentalists and greens in our present day are so concerned about nature, about the environment, but they only care, most of them, about wild animals in nature, and they fail to see domestic animals or even humans as part of nature.
That is more so in North America, I have discovered, than in Europe. Nature here is really immediately wild nature. So what you see here that is a strange division of labor between movements. For instance, this whole outrage about what is done to living, feeling, sentient nature in factory farms, that is not the terrain of environmentalists or ecologists. That's the terrain of the animal rights movement here. Because the environmentalists here have already drawn an impassable line between themselves, human centers, human industries, and that nature that has been incorporated in human living systems, including pets, including production animals and research animals. So the only nature that is still nature for environmentalists is nature that is still wild. But what they forget, of course, is that there's still our bodies are still nature. The whole medical science knows that our bodies are nature. So what they do is, and I find that strange, instead of emphasizing that we, of course, are also animals and that we have mammal bodies, they define nature narrowly as only wildlife. And they concentrate their efforts, and I applaud those efforts on conserving wildlife. But the ability to feel pain, the ability to feel fear, the ability to enjoy life is also nature. It's not wild nature that lies out there green, but it is the nature that humans and animals have in common. It's not a green nature. It's not a spatial nature that you can actually, a tangible nature that is outside, but it is the measure in which the human species is nature, and with the human species, all the animals that we now exploit to the extreme. So I think that sentience is of course the ability to feel and to suffer, that the notion of sentience should be part of the notion of environment or the notion of nature that environmentalists should adhere to, and that is often lacking. That is one of the reasons that that's one of the theoretical reasons that I've written this book, to have the notion to instill in people the idea what nature really means. It's not just wild out there. It is the ability to feel pain and the ability to suffer is nature.
My guest is Barbara Noska. The book is Beyond Boundaries, Humans and Animals. You have some fascinating things in the book, descriptions of animals communicating with each other, communicating with mm-hmm. humans, and what really intrigued me were your stories of humans who were raised or grew up or lived with animals, especially the gazelles.
Yeah.
That was just amazing to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you write a book, you know how many academic books, this is an academic book, but it is, I've written it in view of, you know, like it should be approachable for the, say, educated reader. And academic books are often so boring. They peter out, you know, at a certain stage in the book. You've used all your arguments, you've given all your examples, and then the conclusion is obvious and people fall asleep. And I didn't want to write a book like that. So I was just wondering, my God, how should I end this book? And I suddenly had it. I thought, I've written extensively about the human-animal relationship. I should, of course, end with a typical animal-human relationship, and the event where animals adopt a human child in their midst and raise it as though it was an animal child is very much an animal-human relationship. It's the animals that instigate the the adoption. It's not. It's usually a helpless human being that is left to die or is lost in a jungle. Incidentally, that won't happen very much anymore because we're quickly turning the whole world into a concrete jungle. So not many human children will ever get lost anymore in real jungle. Jungles, but still it has happened. We know of about 600 cases where, not 650 cases in the last hundreds of years where documented and less documented instances have occurred. Of course, the most well-known is the case of wolf children, Romulus and Remus, the mythological founders of the city of Rome, but that was a myth. They were also reared by wolves. But also, well, we have enough evidence that children have really been reared by wolf mothers and in wolf dens. But there's also, as you said, there are three instances of gazelle children. Of children that have been found by herds of gazelles and raised in a herd. And what is so remarkable is that, of course, these two species were born with very different equipment. I mean, human children don't have twitching ears. They don't have a tail with which they can indicate moods. They often have no scent glands at the back of their body. So all kinds of communication, means of communications, they have to invent among themselves. And still, apparently, we are not so different from animals that we can't form societies together. So yeah, it's really amazing how humans in an early stage can be acculturated. Is that a word?
Acculturated.
Uh-huh. Acculturated. Sorry, English is not my first language, as you can hear.
You're doing
acculturated,
wonderful.
As gazelles, or, you know, like socialized as gazelles. And that just shows two things, that there is not an impassable line, even culturally not, between humans and other animals, and also that humans, in order to really become fully human, need a human social context. And if they don't get that social context early in life, they become not in their body. In their body, they stay human. But they, socially and culturally, they become animals. And it also shows that animals can, in fact, transmit culture. Because, I mean, there's, of course, no genetic pre-programming in either the gazelles or the children to make sure that the gazelles can teach children. And on the other hand, that children can adopt gazelle children, gazelle culture. That is all done by way of learning. It's not done by way of genes. There are no genes for that in any of those species. So it's really it's really amazing. It has really challenged ideas about what is humanness and what is animalness.
Barbara, you give some fascinating examples of different animals communicating among themselves and also with humans,
mm-hmm.
Animals using a variety of tools. I was very surprised to hear that noted intellectual and pundit Noam Chomsky doesn't think that chimpanzees can communicate.
Well, he doesn't call it language. I mean, that is the big. I mean, Chomsky, by the way, also we have the same publisher in Canada. Black Rose is also Chomsky's publisher here, and of course that touches upon another very interesting debate. In progressive leftist, you would say in the United States, probably liberal circles. People are not at all that liberal about human-animal continuity. I mean, a lot of leftist ideas about the world really depend on a strict hierarchy between humans and animals. And Chomsky virtually says that animal language is can't be called language, that it is just communication, that it is stereotyped communication, so that's mainly instinctive, that animals have little idea that what they do is communicating. Like, for instance, when you hit your toe against something and you say ouch, or here they say ow, you do so regardless of another person present. You do this almost instinctively. Now, that is the way, I'm simplifying now, but that's the way he looks upon animal language, whereas there is he also doesn't know the literature. Also, people in the humanities and social science often don't read the new discoveries about animals, so he still dismisses animal communication, of course, as lower than human communication, but he doesn't think it deserves the term language. And I give ample examples in the book that I think show that it is language. It might not be verbal language, but I mean, humanity is not the measure of all things. That's another very important point in the book. I mean, anthropocentrism is really about how we see humanity as the measure of the world. Now, well, you know, there are other things. There are other ways in which beings can stand in the world. I always give the example of, for instance, a dog. A dog is not very far removed from anybody's life in urban North America. For us, you have an expression in English, seeing is believing. And all scientific proof that we have is really depends, is based on seeing. You know, like in laboratories, everything is based on visual proof. Now, for a dog can see very well, but what he believes or what she believes is not his eyes, it's his nose. So for a dog, smelling or scenting would be believing. So, you know, the dog's sense of smell is so much more superior than ours, about 100 times more, that a dog's language is probably in terms of smell. Now, if you would transport that to the human world and you would say in a laboratory, you would alert people to scent proofs in terms of scent, they would immediately dismiss that. Yeah, but scent is so subjective. How can you say something is proven? You know, like a dog would say. We would say, look, it's obvious. A dog would probably say, if it could talk, it would say, smell, it's obvious. And we would immediately dismiss that as totally subjective. I mean, that just shows that with animals, we should also do justice to their otherness. They stand in the world in an other way than we, almost in an alien way, which doesn't mean lower, it just means other. And also, animals have been here so much longer than we have. I mean, we are really a young species. And instead of being modest and being respectful of that which is so much older than us, there's an environmental philosopher here in Canada, John Livingston, who uses the word previousness. I mean, it's respect for previousness, also respect for otherness, that is totally lacking. I mean, we judge everything according to our standards, and then if things are deviating, they're automatically lower or worth less than we are. I mean, it's this human arrogance that this book is also directed against. Also, the arrogance in the left and in progressive and liberal circles. I come from the left myself, so.
And we often think of feminism as a liberal social belief, as a liberal discipline, and you have some differences of opinion with some feminists.
Yeah. Well, feminism, of course, is an umbrella term. They're very different brands of feminism. There's, of course, the what is called equity feminism, the feminism that rightly shows that well, women in a lot of ways haven't got the same chances for centuries that men had. Then there's now very, very popular postmodern feminism. And there's, in North America, and that's very, very characteristic of only North America, it's almost non-existent in Europe, and that's ecofeminism. And ecofeminism is a kind of mixture of environmental concerns, seeing humanity as part of nature and not as above nature, and gender issues. And of course, yeah, I draw attention in my book to the fact that genders and sexes don't stop at the species boundary. Of course, there were the human species is not the only one that has two sexes. I mean, almost all animal species have two sexes. And there's, as we have certain images of the two genders, these images are actually being transported across the species boundary and projected onto animal species as well. And if you look at the general accounts of female and male roles in the animal world, you see that there's also sexism there in the ways that humans and human scientists and even feminists look at the sexes in the animal world. You often hear the opinion, yeah, but you know, it is dangerous for feminists to even acknowledge human-animal continuity, because in nature female animals are being oppressed. Well, anything you can think of, you will find in nature. There are animal species where the female is absolutely dominant. There are animal species where the female, after intercourse, eats the male. There are animals. Yeah, I mean, there's, and then biologists, of course, dismiss that as well. There's no longer any biological use for the male, so the female can as well eat him. There's also so-called harem societies where there's one male dominating a whole lot of females. Horse societies are like that. But it should be noted that it's true there's a dominant stallion with a whole lot of mares, but it's always an old, experienced mare that leads the herd, that decides where the herd is going. So the picture of nature is not black-white. It's not simplistically... you can't say that nature is sexist. Anything, any kind of relation between the sexes, you will be able to find in nature. So the whole idea that nature is that placing humanity back into nature is anti-feminist is wrong. It's not anti-feminist. It is, of course, humanity is part of nature. We haven't separated ourselves. We are still being born as mammals. We reproduce as mammals. We die as mammals. Our body is mammalian. I mean, we are not natural bodies. And on top of that is a totally unnatural culture. Also, thinking in terms of those kind of dichotomies, dualisms, is very, very much part of Western philosophy, but I attack that in the book. I mean, also animals have culture. It is not as though animals are nature and we are culture. We're both, albeit maybe in different forms.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. My 1997 interview with Barbara Noska. She joined us on the telephone in Canada. And she's originally from Holland. And what an intellectual she is. What an amazing thinker. I loved talking to her, and I loved her passion for this subject. We'll bring you our final segment of this conversation, but first this. Closing out the Best of the Book Nook today with our final segment of an interview I did in 1997 with a woman in Canada named Barbara Noska. Back in the 1990s, she coined a term called animal industrial complex. And if you're listening to this interview, I think you understand what she's talking about. The way we treat animals. Do we think about it? Do we think about our relationships with animals? Do we think about the fact that we are also animals? It's easy to have that species boundary where you think that you're superior to animals, and a lot of people do. Do you have a cat or a dog or a gerbil or an animal companion that is dear to you? Do you believe they have feelings? Do you care deeply about them? I hope you'll listen to this final segment with Barbara Noska as we talk about our relationships with animals on the Best of the Book Nook.
Barbara, I see a link here between the destruction of nature, the destruction of the environment, the use of factory farms to create as much product as possible.
In Europe, they talk in terms of mountains of meat and lakes of milk. We overproduce just for this, not for the sake of feeding ourselves. We produce only for profit. And sorry, but I was interrupting you.
Money, yes, I see the link. How else could we justify torturing thousands of animals to create cosmetics?
Oh well, that's another thing, of course. I mean. Yes, cosmetics is an incredibly trivial way of using animals. I mean, roughly people estimate that a new cosmetic product appears on the market every week, and many countries actually require companies to test on animals. Otherwise, the product is not being approved of. But of course, there's no logical point at which you stop. It was said by a writer sometime, you can as well feed animals safety pins, because at one stage, certainly a human child will swallow a safety pin one day. Is that a reason to feed safety pins to animals to see how dangerous it is for the mammalian body? Yeah, well,
so when you say test, you really mean torture or poison?
I mean feeding. What they do is they feed animals these substances. They even make animals smoke. They let them inhale things. In lots of ways, they force these substances on animal bodies. And and here is the contradiction, because all these experimenters know very well that, of course, there's human-animal continuity. That's the basis on which experiments are done. If there was no continuity between animal and human bodies, there was no point in experimentation. But apparently, there is the factual recognition of that continuity, but ethically, suddenly, the continuity is being denied. I mean, things are tested on animals because they are of another species. People wouldn't dream of doing this to humans, and certainly not such trivial things as cosmetics. I mean, people even test artificial Christmas tree snow on animals. I mean, yeah, well, there is the theoretical chance that a human child will swallow a piece of that snow. Well, yeah, okay. But, you know, my own father died of lung cancer because he smoked. I mean, lots and lots of animals are made to smoke cigarettes, and we use them in car accidents, we use them in space navigation, we use them in domestic riot control things, we use them in all thinkable ways. And of course, there are less trivial uses, like, for instance, AIDS research or cancer research. I can understand that, if you yourself have a terminal disease or your family has that, that the idea of using animals is more that is more defensible than using animals for cosmetics. But I think behind this whole discussion is the idea that the medical science will eventually conquer all disease, and I don't think that is going to happen. I mean, just before I was born, the terminal disease was pneumonia. It was not cancer, and it was not AIDS. And even as we are talking, new diseases will spring up. The idea that science can eventually conquer nature is a false idea. I think that we have to come to terms with the fact that we are mortal, and that most of us, or maybe many of us, will die of diseases. Yeah, well, diseases are also part of nature. Animals die of diseases, also wild animals. I don't see why we are exempt from that. I mean, death is part of life. And the whole idea that we are there to transcend life, I think, is a false idea.
My guest is Barbara Noska, and the book is Beyond Boundaries, Humans and Animals. Barbara, I think we could probably talk on a variety of subjects for quite some time.
Yeah, I know you have only so many minutes.
Yeah, well, we've burned them up pretty well. I must comment, I was fascinated by the anecdotal information you had about animals dreaming. I think many of us have seen this. I frequently see a dog who belongs to one of my friends, mm-hmm. who is asleep, and she runs and she barks muted.
She runs, she uses her paws.
She sniffs, yeah. She wiggles her paws.
Yeah,
she's clearly out running through the meadow chasing a squirrel.
Yeah, yeah.
And you had the story about the horse who was asleep.
Yeah, racehorses do that often in their... the horse that calls.
Right.
Yeah, that is a German example. It comes out of a book written by a German vet and a horse expert. And this was a young horse. Young horses first use a real false voice, and then later that voice changes. But in his dream, he was apparently still a child, so he called in this false voice, and a mare that was in a meadow a reasonable distance away immediately answered the call. So yeah, this vet really thought that he concludes from that the horse that was no longer a foal but was still young remembered or dreamed that he was still a foal. So yeah, things like that. I must say that this book is academic, sure, but I don't see why only scientific or strictly scientific evidence is evidence. I think that in a lot of situations, in real life, experiences of ordinary people, also of non-scientific people, are still experiences that count. I mean, people that work with animals, people that train animals, people who meet animals, all these people have experiences with animals. And so this book is probably unusual that it also gives status to non-scientific instances of human-animal relationships. And I don't see why those experiences shouldn't be included in a book. I mean, science is not the only form of truth. There are many truths in this society, and a lot of anecdotal things have a ground. And of course, it is also because they are anecdotal, they're often not written down, so they stay anecdotal. I mean, it's the same thing as going to the doctor and saying, I am taking this medicine, and according to me, it has this and this and this effect. And the doctor just says, well, that hasn't been shown in scientific literature. Even if 50 people come to the same doctor and all report this effect, it will not be written down because it's already being dismissed as being anecdotal, so not scientific. So it will never get the status of scientific proof. Because this in this society, of course, what religion was first, religion in the Middle Ages really was the legitimizer of truth. If the priest said it, it was true. Nowadays, if science says it, it's true. So science has taken over that normative and legitimating role. And so we tend to, especially in academia, we tend to not look further than only science. And I think that makes the life experiences poorer than it should be. I mean, of course, poets have a truth that you know, alert us to truth that science can't alert us to. So I tend to include these other truths in my thinking as well.
Well, Barbara, I am finding some irony in the fact that scientists and academics tend to be the ones in your book who treat animals as objects. And you're saying...
Yeah, well, also people, it's not just thinkers, eh? It's also doers.
Uh-huh.
People who do things with animals. I mean, we were mentioning factory farms. Although they get more and more scientific, of course, industry and science now come nearer and nearer to each other. It's not just thinkers; it's also doers. I mean, I'm here on a continent where there's a lot of hunting going on as sport. And to give you a measure of the species boundary, I'm playing the devil's advocate, probably, but that's what a writer should do. Killing someone for fun at this side of the species boundary is called murder. Killing someone for fun at the other side of the species boundary is called sport or amusement. I mean, and this gives you a measure of what the species boundary means. At this side, it's called ethically wrong. At that side, it's called sport, or maybe it's called culling or something, or something. Anyway, there's no ethical term for it. There's a technical term for it.
Point well taken. My guest has been Barbara Noska. The book is Beyond Boundaries, Humans and Animals, published by Black Rose Books. Barbara, thanks so much for talking to our listeners in Southwest Ohio.
Yeah, well, it was a pleasure. It was a pleasure. And it's good to have an in-depth possibility to talk without commercials in between.
Well, that's the beauty of public radio.
Yeah, exactly.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my only interview with Barbara Noska. She joined us on the telephone in Canada almost 30 years ago, back in 1997, to talk about her book and to talk about our relationship with animals. And I've been digging into the 1997 archive and finding some goodies. And tomorrow, we'll bring you another Best of the Book Nook from 1997, 29 years ago. My only interview at 10:30 tomorrow morning with John Katzenbach. He had a thriller out called State of Mind. He has gone on to be quite a successful novelist. In fact, he was a big name when we did this interview almost 30 years ago. And he's still putting out books. And he got his start, like a lot of crime novelists, writing for a newspaper. He wrote for the Miami Herald. He was a crime reporter. And there's another very famous crime novelist who wrote for a paper in Florida. Michael Connelly went on then to write for the paper in Los Angeles. And then a huge career as a crime novelist, much bigger than John Katzenbach, I might add, but still, John Katzenbach, a great writer, and we're going to bring you that only interview tomorrow morning to talk about his book, State of Mind, It's about a serial killer. The Best of the Book Nook, tomorrow morning at 10:30, right here on your public radio station, WYSO. Thanks, as always, for tuning in, and thanks for your support.